A very warm welcome to the Curiotitas International podcast. And today we're doing an episode on international anthroposophy with our special guest, Rembert Beaumont, which I'll talk a bit more about. But first of all, I have to claim that everything being said on this episode represents only ourselves. So we are not representing any institutions or other companies. Only ourselves. And we are very grateful for feedback at the curiotituspod.com, gmail.com. And otherwise, you can comment on YouTube or on the podcast channels. So, that being said, very welcome, Rembert. And we invited you here because, out of a Swedish perspective, you're an international expert on anthroposophy. Being born in Holland and working a long time at the Goetheanum in Dornach, Switzerland. And nowadays you are in different boards over the world, the whole globe. So that's the reason why we asked you. And I know you have been very sort of anthroposophic through your whole life. So that's sort of the background to everything being said, which goes for me as well. My name is Erland Kornfeld. And we are both Waldorf pupils, which is some sort of the positive side as we regard it. That being said, very welcome, Rembert. Do you want to add something to your
curriculum? Much. Thank you very much for having me. And I applaud your initiative, even if I think it is quite a mouthful to call something a Curiotitas pod. but thanks for having me, and let's see where it takes us.
And perhaps I should comment on that, because that's sort of with a tweak of the eye, because if you are very deep into anthroposophy, you know that Curiotitas are the spiritual side of wisdom, which is sort of said more out of a joke.
And
we'll see how we land that.
And that's why I am hesitant to claim that anything I would say would come into that category.
Wow. Yeah. We're sort of the lower hierarchies. Well,
where do you want me to start?
Yeah, that's the question. And I think being sort of positioning yourself in the middle of Europe nowadays, perhaps we could start with how does anthroposophy look out of a main or central European perspective, even out of history?
Well, that's a big question. And I think then we first have to speak about anthroposophy.
Yeah, I'm glad.
And I like the following joke, or not joke, it's whatever that's called in English. But do you know what the difference is between theory and practice?
No.
Well, in theory it is the same, but in practice it is not.
Very good.
Yeah.
And we perhaps start with the practical side of anthroposophy then.
So that is a very important distinction.
Mm.
Because I think we have to speak about, what is anthroposophy?
Mm-hmm.
And then you can speak about the anthroposophical movement, and you can speak about the development of the anthroposophical movement, and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so how I understand it, that is that the wording anthroposophical movement is used by Steiner in the first place, not at the accumulation of practical initiatives, but actually as a spiritual thing.
Mm-hmm.
So other than mainstream science of nowadays, who still have, although it is crumbling, have a empty materialistic cosmos. It is crumbling, that view, but Steiner had a very different view,
mm-hmm.
and that is that there is not only human consciousness, but also all kinds of other things who are spiritual, meaning not material.
Mm.
And he speaks of anthroposophy as a spiritual movement, which means that it is for sure not a theory. It is not a body of books. It is not an accumulation of bits and bytes. It is not a set of dogmas. It is not the Ten Commandments. It is, and you name it. But it is not so easy. There, I like always to try many different ways of saying it, or searches to speak about it. One way, if I, I've sometimes done the exercise, okay, you can only use one word. What is anthroposophy?
Mm-hmm.
And then I like to say it is an initiative.
Mm-hmm.
Or another thing would be it is a verb. So it is something living. But it is not easy to grab. And when you think you have it, it might run away.
Mm-hmm.
So that is what I would like to say first about anthroposophy, yeah. that it is not so easy to grab as many other things. If you go deeper, it might be more difficult to grab it. But anthroposophy has a certain task for the development of the world, for the development for humanity, for individual development. It's not an easy thing.
Mm.
And then I come to how, if nowadays people talk about the anthroposophical movement, they usually mean the incredible amount of initiatives who have developed during 100 years, who are in the thousands, in the many thousands nowadays, who somehow are inspired out of anthroposophy. Only here in Jerna, we have at least 100, if not more, initiatives, legal bodies who do something which is somehow inspired out of anthroposophy, with a very big concentration in the field you come from.
And would you say that anthroposophy has sort of a role of fermentation or sort of getting things going, that the impact has been rather big? Well, much bigger than the amount of anthroposophists or anthroposophical institutions.
Maybe, yes. So, if you look at other spiritual movements, including Theosophy or TM, or even also churches or the yoga movement or so on. And then you look, okay, but what has the impact been on sort of other parts of society, then it is for me so that the impact on society of anthroposophy has been enormous. And interesting enough, Steiner came to that only in the very, very last part of his life. So Steiner died when he was 64, when I'm not mistaken, and it were the last 25 years that he was really sort of really visible and had kind of a audience.
Mm.
That didn't happen until he was well in his 40s.
Mm.
But it's only the last couple of years that all those movements, be it in agriculture, be it in health, be it in education, they were mainly of the last few years. So during his lifetime, there were actually almost no anthroposophical institutions. The biggest one was the school in Stuttgart, who had some traction, let's call it, and pupils. But the other things, they were, you know, just a small start of a clinic, curative education, and even agriculture was in the last year of his life. So that was all very small. And then there was a body of 12,000 members. So that was very different from nowadays. Yet this foundation or background or all of that is, I believe, very important.
Mm. Would you say that it is important to define yourselves as anthroposophists, or doesn't that matter?
Well, now you come in difficult terrain, because I think I am even unsure if it is of a good help to use the word.
Mm.
Because it is just like so many other words which has been used too much in too many directions.
Mm.
And it might easy come to misunderstandings or so.
Mm.
Because I believe anthroposophy is science. So I believe that is extremely central in understanding anthroposophy, that Steiner wanted it to be an addition, a parameter shift, but with a basically scientific method.
Mm.
So you have had a lot of paradigm shifts in the course of history.
Mm.
You know, the world is flat, the world is flat, the world is round. You know, the sun is the middle of the universe. Ah, no, it's actually different. Mm. And we have had many other paradigm shifts. And Steiner takes the position that we actually can be scientific about the spiritual world.
Mm.
That is his take.
Mm.
Very few people have been able to do exactly that themselves.
Mm.
So we have ended up in quoting a lot of Steiner. But he didn't want to have a fan base. He wanted to have people who understood him.
Mm.
And who would go the same,
yeah.
Who would do the same method. And then I could come to many examples. But I think for the further development of anthroposophy, it will be ultimately imperative that now Steiner covered, and that is in a way even a problem, he covered sort of the universe.
Mm.
But at least in certain aspects that we can actually see parts of what he has seen,
mm.
and then was speaking about.
Mm.
So I could give many examples. But I believe for the future of anthroposophy that is very imperative, because there's also a lot of anthroposophical lingo. Other people might actually mean the same and using another word.
Mm.
And I think it is very, very important to come to a situation. Yeah, can you also say it in other words? And that includes for me, the word anthroposophy.
Yeah. I think it's, I'm agreeing on that, because if you make this historic comparison, it's like the same process, because the situation of the globe has been the same, depending on what we think.
Yes.
And you have to sort of, through science or through the way of thinking, get closer to examine how it is.
Yeah.
And that would be, for me, the same with the spiritual world. It exists, but you can act as if it doesn't exist.
Yes.
That's a possibility which has to do with the historical development.
Yeah.
And that's why you have to sort of make these steps, and that would be sort of the call for us or for anybody.
Yeah.
You don't have to be an anthroposophist to make that move.
And not
to
at all.
Examining how the spiritual world really looks like.
Not at all.
And that's, I agree, that's why I think Rudolf Steiner called it a spiritual science. And I think we have to do a lot of work, and I don't know if it looks different in Europe. Where are these steps made?
I am afraid I got a bit lost. You are coming back to your first question. How does it look from a Middle European perspective? All of that. Yes, so Steiner has traveled, but not so far. You know, from Oslo to Sicily and from somewhere in Romania to
England, France,
West England, and that's it. And nowadays you have anthroposophy all over the globe.
Mm.
And interesting enough, in outside Europe, sometimes very interesting developments. So I like to say you know, if we now we are in a pod, and our unit of time is maybe minutes of, or maybe an hour or 2-3/4 of an hour. But if you look to anthroposophy, I like to look at least in generations. So a generation is 30, 35 years, three in a century. And we have now three generations of anthroposophy. Now, how is this going to look in 100 years?
Tell me.
Three generations on, or even a larger amount of time. But I believe, I'll speak about that in a minute, but if you look, how has the development been 100 years? You have still a lot of people who are now very focused on the beginning. And especially in sort of the institutionalized anthroposophy and in some people who are active in membership, especially not so much in the leadership, but in Switzerland, southern Germany, and so on. And they are very retro-focused. Yet there's sort of everything should be like Steiner said in 1925. I think that's a little bit a hopeless position, because you have to start from where we are now. You know, there's no other way. Of course, you can then be inspired by this or that, but you have to start where we are now, in the situation where we are now. And I believe anthroposophy has something to contribute for many centuries to come. So I do believe that that sort of what we have now is actually a very small niche of what could be the importance of anthroposophy in the future.
And I could try a thought on you, because sometimes people say there is a start and there is a beginning, and you should tear down things to make possible for new things to develop. Or is it possible to change something old and renew it? Because if you look at the world, and I know you will speak about that because you're part of it, a lot of interesting things are happening as new things in other parts of the world, rather than in Europe or in Middle Europe.
Well, I am a little bit more of an evolutionary person. I'm not immediately for it to tear down something ourselves. But when the old house is crumbling, then we should build a new one. But I don't think we have to tear it down ourselves. But so let's speak about Dornach. Then I think
That was the underlying question.
Any other position than that, it should have a very different role in 100 years than it had 100 years ago would be, in my opinion, an absurd position. You know, I want to have many acupunctural points of anthroposophy in many different ways. And so does the leadership in Gatiano. So to think the position that sort of out of Dornach is sort of officially sanctioned anthroposophy spreading into the world is a position which is, in my opinion, not useful, and which reminds of Rome. I see no legal basis. I see no other spiritual basis for that in any way. That has to spread out. I was telling you when we were speaking before that I worked for the Gotianum a couple of years, and then at that time the chairman was called Manfred Schmid Brabant, and he wanted to build a Gautianum in Asia and one in North America. That didn't happen in that way, but he had that idea. And I liked that very much. And of course, it has. There has to be somebody who does it.
Mm.
And that happened. It didn't happen in that way. But I even was myself present when here in Jena, the culture house. At that time, it was called Anthroposophien's Huis.
Mm-hmm. House of Anthroposophy.
House of Anthroposophy. And they were planning that. It was must have been late 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And then Arne Klingborg, who was one of the key figures here, he was traveling at least twice a year to the Gautianum, and I happened to be present in a discussion where also my teacher, Jürgen Schmidt, who was very involved in Jena as well, was present, and Schmidt Brabant asked it, yeah, guys, that's great, you're now building this. Can you call it Gautianum, please? And Arne declined, because he said nobody knows Goethe in Sweden.
Mm.
Well, whatever was the reason, I in a way think it is a pity, because it wouldn't have been, it wouldn't have been competition, or if at all, it would have been so inspiring. So I still hope that in another round that somehow happens.
Mm.
I cannot think it in a different way. You know, the spirit goes where it wants, and is a very fluid thing.
Mm.
And I hope for Dornach that it will play a nice role in the future as well, of some kind.
But in some senses, it's not foreseeable, because if you look at the events in Dornach, it's more in the other direction, so getting more narrowed by regulations, votes, and so on. So it doesn't give that creative impression, looked out from the outside at least.
If you look at things like general assemblies and that kind of stuff, I agree. I tend to see it also a little bit broader. If I speak about Dornach, you know, who is there and what are they doing?
Mm.
And then you have seen very inspirational faces of certain sections.
Mm.
So I always want to be an optimist, and I see also always some nice developments.
Mm.
But I can feel with you also about, you know, if you the General Assembly has been a catastrophe for many decades in many ways.
Mm.
Yeah.
But speaking about more positive aspects, I know you're, for example, very involved in Egypt, which is nowadays perhaps not so new anymore, but still in the Dornach perspective new.
Yeah, well, it is. I had the privilege to meet the founder of this, Ibrahim Abilais, already in the 90s, when it was still quite young. Mm. At that time, we had at the Gautianum a big conference about the world religions,
mm-hmm.
and he was invited to speak about Islam. And I was somehow assigned to him as his personal translator, because he didn't speak so well English at that time.
Mm.
He did speak very well German, because he had studied in Austria.
Mm.
And now Sekem is 45 years old, and it is has become a big thing, and with a lot of interest, and it is like an intentional community with farms, greening the desert initiatives, with a university with not less than 3,000 students now, Heliopolis University for Sustainable Development. Mm. There is a Waldorf inspired school, there's curative education, there is reforesting of the desert.
Mm.
There is, it's amazing.
Mm.
And there is an incredible lot of interest for it also, because Egypt is otherwise not sort of so much at the forefront of sustainability and that kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
So it is it has gained a lot of interest, and from an anthroposophical perspective, one can say that Sekem is partly inspired by anthroposophy, and otherwise also a new way or a modern way or a way in a completely different culture, in an Islamic culture.
Mm.
They're just coming out of Ramadan right now. Mm. And then I can tell you, during Ramadan, it's a different story in an Islamic country. And for Ibrahim Obulaj, anthroposophy was something which it helped him, so he said, to become a better Muslim. Mm. While he also was very, very positive about Christianity, mm. As about other certain mm. religions.
And I think that's a very interesting question, because I can sort of feel that it applies to me as well. I could give the same answer if somebody would ask me, why are you an anthroposophist? It enlarges my thoughts or my development. I become a bigger person through anthroposophy. So it's very interesting that even it works even dealing with Islam.
Oh, absolutely. You know, because also as all big religions, you know, you have many, many denominations, directions. Also within mm. Islam, you of course have the extreme Sharia on one side, and then you have the Sufism on another side, mm. And everything in between. Yeah. And then you have other things. And Ibrahim Obulaj was working himself very much with trying to understand the Quran, also in maybe other ways than other people do it. Mm. And he could do that because of his sort of broad education, including anthroposophy.
Mm. And there are different areas of development in which perhaps anthroposophy can play a role in the future. And I know that you're especially interested in economy. Could you tell something about your thoughts about how anthroposophy can enlarge your view of economy?
Yeah, I like the question. So I tell it a little bit personal, and that was and then I'll choose a second entrance mm-hmm. to the same mm-hmm. question.
Yeah, sure.
So when I was 18, I had very much the feeling, yes, okay, you have this field of anthroposophy where there is already quite some traction, like education, curative education, health, mm. and agriculture. But at that time, the traction in economy was very little.
Mm.
There was not, and one could say that Steiner's own effort with politics / society, thoughts about society, had failed completely.
Mm.
So there was this this whole thing of sort of so-called threefold social order, where you for a couple of years in the aftermath and partly during the First World War was trying to figure out how society could be organized, and then that it didn't work, and he then abolished that focus, and he said, okay, let's then do something for the kids at least, so yeah. that it there might be coming. So when I was 18, I couldn't explain it very much, but I was searching for, okay, alternative ways of dealing with economy different than mainstream economics, mm. which was and is at that time capitalism and market economy mm. and all the theories related to that. So I went the way of studying that while actually wanting to study something else. Now, 40 years on, or 45, you see that there is a lot happened. So we have the banks who are somehow inspired out of anthroposophy, mm. With Triodos in Europe, not only in the Netherlands, but also a couple of other countries, and the so-called GLS Bank has both started in the late 60s, 70s. They are quite big now, mm. and they are somehow inspired by what you in English could call new economy. which is an associative economy, which is not I win, you lose, but is a win-win economy. Mm. And is the short version of it is a stakeholder economy. Interesting enough, if the extreme version, it is still so that if you have a stock market quoted company in the US, you have to put the shareholders first.
Mm.
Yeah, so you cannot put, if you put the environment or the co-workers or your clients or your other stakeholders on top, or then your shareholders can actually sue you.
Mm.
Because you are not going after their interest first. Mm. So that is sort of the extreme shareholders first thing, which is even legally sealed.
Mm.
And an associative economy is a win-win economy, which is basically a stakeholder economy, that if you are, let's say, you have to make all your stakeholders happy. That's basically the thought of an associative economy. And it is also leads to other thoughts about ownership. You know, purpose-driven ownership. So that's economy, and that has been for myself a red thread in my life, which interested me very much.
But I'm quite interested in societal questions as well. So the question is, what do you have to do to succeed in your own process to acknowledge the benefits of a new economy, because it doesn't grow very fast.
Well, yes, that with grow and not grow and with numbers, it can be very relative sometimes, and it can also change very fast. I also always believe in that we live in a very statistical world where we talk about dollars and billions and trillions and... But sometimes things can shift also quite fast, and you have to be practical and to try again. But I agree there. You could say, yeah, it's not growing very fast, but I see it different. I see how much thought was there about this in the 1970s, and how is it now?
Mm.
And that's a very big difference. I don't know if you realize that, and that would be a whole extra pod, but let's speak about true cost accounting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're familiar with the term, but it basically means that you got to calculate the true costs into a product. That means if you pollute the environment, or you do something else negative, yeah, okay. But it should, at least you should pay for it, and it should be... Now, this true cost accounting thing, which nobody heard of like 15 years ago, and now it is becoming mainstream.
Mm.
That the thought in academics, and it becomes so much mainstream that... although we now live in a year with the Ukrainian war and so that the oil companies made a hell of a lot of money again in 1 year. But in the 70s, in the stock market, the top 10, 7 of them were oil companies.
Mm.
Now it is 0. Mm. And the thought about with true cost company, true cost accounting, it means that Shell... instead of having enormous assets under the ground, now might have a liability.
Mm.
And that is how pension funds start to think, how investment funds start to think, how... So there are actually happening some bigger shifts here and there.
But can you see that anthroposophy has contributed to the shift of thinking?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So no doubt. I could show you the certain traces and, and sort of, so this whole idea of transparency comes very much out of anthroposophical inspired, that you can see that you even in a sort of complicated supermarket economy, still you can go to a code and you can see, okay, this avocado comes from Jose in there and there in Spain, and that you get kind of this kind of connection. This whole total transparency through cost accounting, CO2 calculations, you can see how anthroposophists and people familiar with this kind of thinking have very much been part of the birth of this, even if it now spreads to people who have never heard of it.
And I ask because you are part of at least some foundations. Can you sort of, you don't see it from the outside, but from the inside, is there a change in the ways you go about true cost economy or?
Well, I believe at least in Europe it is it is a lot of things are spreading. So you could take the wording in German, you call it Verantwortungseigentum. In English you call it purpose-driven companies. And where there is actually a much larger movement than where sort of owners of mid-size and bigger companies, they decide, no, it is wrong to see the ownership of this company as a commodity which can be, sold. And so sometimes it has already a long background, but some of the very strong supermarkets, like Migros in Switzerland, they are purpose owned. Some other big companies are purpose owned, which means that the company somehow owns itself. Because if you put a stock market price on a company, it actually puts the company always under big pressure, because then you have sort of this money must make money and growth is the only thing and so on. So I'm hopeful there.
But can you go as far as you having insight in how boards look from the inside on a higher level, that there is a change possible from the top, so to speak, rather from
The market forces and making money is very, very strong. But I see hopeful developments time and again. You know that big companies nowadays have sustainability officers who have actually something to say. And then you can have many examples also of companies who go there very far, like Patagonia, or there. It's a big thing now if you put everything together. It might still be very small percentage wise of the total economy, but there we come to an interesting thing, and that is tipping points. I am so excited if we talk about new economy. I have been the CEO of a fruit and veg company in Germany for 10 years. Now, may I tell a story there?
Yeah, sure.
So, in fruit and veg, bananas is a very big thing. A lot of people eat bananas, and it is a strange commodity. They don't grow in Europe. They are basically imported from Middle America. It's a big business. If in ICA or Co-op here, it's 1% of the turnover. You wouldn't, bigger than Coca-Cola in terms of one single project. Now, if somebody would have told me in Sweden there are no conventional bananas anymore on the market, I wouldn't have believed it.
No,
but it is the case.
Yes, I didn't even know that.
And it is totally amazing. But it happened because in Sweden you still have that, other than, you know, you have sort of the Lidl system, where an individual owner of a co-op, an individual co-op can still decide what he does or not does, or ICA the same, mostly. And then there was one guy who tried out, if I sell only organic bananas, do I actually make more money? And he did. So, and then other people started to copy it. And then it's now already 5 or 6 years ago, but then somewhere in Norrland, so this changed relatively fast, that they found out, instead of selling two, bananas is difficult because they are either too green or too black.
Yeah.
It's a difficult story if you are into the banana business, which I've been. And if you actually sell only one sort of bananas, it's easier because, and then if you have only organic bananas, so if this guy in Stockholm found out, he could make equally much money. And then, so Sweden sort of changed very fast. And then there was one guy in Norrland who at a certain moment, he also followed this trend. And then he had a certain, then the market was a little bit disrupted because of this change. Because even Sweden was only 10 million people. If, and then he wrote a placard. I won't say it in Swedish now, but dear customers, I'm sorry. Organic bananas sold out. We have chosen once more to display chemically treated bananas. Please keep out of the reach of children. And, you know, 10 years ago, that guy would be fired.
Yeah.
And now he became social media and he became a hero. He was in talk shows. And Sweden has no more conventional bananas, and even 7-Eleven sells organic bananas and even fair trade. So this is very interesting. Where is the tipping point with somebody, with something? And it is not 51%. You know, there it is the same with renewable energy. So, you know, to come from 2% to 10% is very difficult because it's fivefold. But then to come from 10 to 20% is only doubling. And then to 50 is a little... So it is very interesting. The tipping point for new developments, that it sort of then at a certain moment, the dams break. You know, and that's that's not 51%. So these kind of things happen. If somebody in the 60s would have told, listen, Erland, on cigarettes... half of the package will be a warning in 30 years. Nobody would have believed it. So I'm an optimist.
And the question is perhaps more than what can you do something to make this development or
absolutely, you
go
know,
about
the,
making tipping points.
Yeah, the main thing is what you buy, you order. What you buy, you order. So if you go to a local supermarket, what you buy, you order. That means you tell the supermarket to make more of this. So with a single consumer has so much more power than you think.
Because that's sort of even a question perhaps connecting to anthroposophy or to work with anthroposophy. Is it more a question of working with persons or with institutions?
Well, I believe in persons. You know, it is a very classical chicken and egg question. But I am myself very, very convinced that it always starts with people. Because people make ultimately the laws and the systems. So if you sort of... Marx had a different theory. He said it's the system. You know, the system is killing us. No, I believe all systems are man-made and change starts with people. So that is, nobody will be able to, you know, of course you can then blame the system and our health system and in Sweden and this and that, and it's all so terrible. And yes, people make systems, and then if people change, systems change. So change is possible, and it starts with people.
It's sort of perhaps more a question of enlarging your consciousness.
It is a question of
perhaps in this direction then.
Yes, and you know, this is not necessarily anthroposophy, you know, because I think health is a, I like to people, there's now nowadays an incredible emphasis on health, you know. But let's speak about planetary health. So it is not so difficult to judge what you do, what you buy, what you to judge the impact in terms of planetary health.
Mm-hmm. But sort of conclude this episode would be sort of the message coming across to the viewers and listeners. You have a responsibility of your own to make the change. You can't really wait.
You cannot
for
wait.
Somebody.
No. We come back to, I believe the core word is initiative.
Mm.
So for me, the core word of initiative, of anthroposophy is initiative, and that goes in two directions. It is an initiative towards your own life and your own inner life,
mm-hmm.
which is maybe two things, your inner life and your life. But then it is also an initiative outward to put certain things into practice.
Yeah.
And in the last 100 years, as said, there has been a lot of that. Mm. And the other part is maybe not always so visible. And maybe we have to find also different ways of introducing that and of doing that and... It's nowadays different with reading books, and then reading books who are 100 years old is sometimes difficult for certain people. Okay, then we have to find other ways, and we do pods.
Yeah,
or,
yeah.
I believe that the bigger picture of anthroposophy, which is a spiritual movement in the spiritual world in the first place, which then has in a way incarnated, has a long way to go. And has for centuries to come a meaning and a task.
Yeah.
And yes, it starts with then individuals and then groups of people, intentional communities, doing certain things.
Mm. Thanks a lot for those conclusions, Rembert.
My pleasure.